Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Really excited to have Gray Thomas on the show today. Gray is currently getting his PhD in ecological psychology with a focus on skill development and habit formation. And he also works with Alex Sarama as Strategy for Transforming Sports, which is the overarching company that oversees transforming basketball. Gray and I met through Alex, and honestly, Alex has really become a great friend and mentor to me. And when he has somebody that he wants me to meet, I usually enjoy it. Gray, couldn't be more fired up to have you on board here, and fired up to be working with you too.
Likewise, man. This has been really cool. Like you said, and Alex has become a good friend of mine as well over the past, you know, handful of months that we've been working together. And so anytime he highly recommends someone, I really take time to carve some time out to get to know them and really, really take him for his word for it. And I've enjoyed the many conversations we've had at this point and, you know, the many we're going to have in the future as well. And I feel like I'm getting a crash course in lacrosse at a very, very quick rate too.
I know, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So Gray and I are in the middle of a very, very interesting project, which is we are trying to help Greenwich Youth Lacrosse, a program with about 1,500 kids, learn to adopt and employ an evidence-based approach, which really has to do with ecological dynamics, constraints-led approach, nonlinear pedagogy. And it's an incredible challenge because it's changing the paradigm for the way a lot of people think and coach, but it's also incredibly exciting because if we can pull this off, we're going to be able to have an incredible impact, I think, not only on Greenwich, but I honestly think we could have an impact on youth lacrosse as a whole, on youth sports. This can be a model. And we definitely don't know exactly what we're doing, but we're going to figure it out and we're going to share it with you guys on this podcast today. So, Gray, can you kick us off with explaining to the listeners what is ecological dynamics, constraints-led approach?
Yeah, absolutely.
And nonlinear pedagogy, as well as you can't even know that we could spend 5 hours on those topics.
Yeah, it's funny. NLP is not even necessarily as much of my forte, even though it is a teaching framework, NLP being nonlinear pedagogy. So ecological dynamics comes from a marriage of ecological psychology, which is what I'm getting my PhD in. And that's a branch of psychology that really focuses on not looking at just the individual mental and internal processes that are going on in terms of how you perceive and act in the world. But it's really about that relationship between you and your environment and everything that that constitutes. And then the dynamics part of that comes from dynamical systems theory, which is comes from, it's a branch of mathematics. And it really is the study of complex adaptive systems. So they did this stuff early on with, you know, chemical reactions and like, how can we get these complex behaviors from things that aren't living, right? And really it's from the principles of like self-organization and things like that. And so ecological dynamics was sort of born out of that. It is more sports directed, at least as it's applied today. And it really emphasizes the relationship between the player, the environment, and the task or the goal at hand. So the idea is that players kind of adapt their behavior based off that information that they're perceiving from their surroundings. So it really encourages flexible and adaptable players. So that's really cool. And from there, the constraints-led approach was born. And this is a framework coaching method that's based on the principles of ecological dynamics. So it understands, you know, these three classes of constraints. You have the task or whatever the goal is. It could be the game, you know, or you can slice it down to even smaller slices of the game, the environment, and then player constraints. And you kind of manipulate or change those in a way that guides learning in a way without trying to drill something into the individual and hope that they remember it and pull it out at the exact right time. So again, it encourages self-organization, and it's really big on problem solving and decision making, which I think I have found, and I think you've found through these conversations, that that is probably the most appealing part to coaches. Is every coach I talk to, whether they're trying to adopt this or trying to even push back, or don't even care to, you know, make a differentiation between the two, they want their players to make quicker decisions, right? Quicker decisions just leads to better gameplay and all of these kinds of things. So it really just aims to kind of develop players who can adapt to like the dynamic nature of whatever the game is. And in this case, youth lacrosse.
So to sum it up.
Yeah.
Ecological dynamics has to do with the fact that human beings, the way human beings move is we perceive and we act, and it's instantaneous and it's self-organizing, which means that there's not one way to do anything because every situation is going to be different. Whether this is for every walk of human life, not just coaching lacrosse. If you're running a meeting, going to the bank, shopping, at a dinner party, you're using perception and action coupled together. The traditional process of thought is that we separate and pull apart the skill from and isolate the skill, which is ripping apart the perception and the action, which then doesn't work because it's not how it works. And so therefore this is like the big paradigm shift. And then the constraints-led approach is simply a methodology that leverages the concepts of ecological dynamics. And the more you think about it, the more sense it makes. And so now we have this big challenge of first teaching these concepts to GYL. We did a webinar about a month ago, and Alex Sarama jumped on it. It's an amazing webinar. He's so good at articulating this stuff. It was a total blast. And he was able to sort of explain the ecological dynamics and the constraints-led approach. And then I started to try to apply it to lacrosse. But now we've got this issue of trying to, first of all, get everybody to watch and really think this stuff through. Because it's very hard to change your paradigm if you don't totally understand it. And I feel like you almost need to be able to articulate what is ecological dynamics and what is a constraints-led approach. Why is the theory so important?
I think it's incredibly important. One, I think it's at a baseline, I think it's pretty empowering in the sense of when we talk about athletes, a lot of times people, coaches, bad coaches, will write off athletes for not having the right stuff, not being mentally tough, or not having something inside that is leading to the right behavior. Whereas this theory, I think, and this approach is really empowering in the sense of it makes the coach kind of a designer or an architect of environments that can actually elicit these behaviors. So instead of if something's going wrong with a player or your team and you're not getting the behaviors you want, instead of saying my guys just don't have it or my girls just don't have it, you can actually take a step back and look at what is it that's going on in between the relationship between these players and the environment that's actually leading to these behaviors? And can I change something? Can we make the field smaller? Can we have more interactions in a particular way? Can we divide things up so people are getting more reps in these small-sided games? And kind of what I like to think of it too is it's introducing adversity very quickly in practice too, instead of only leaving it for the game. Because a lot of times, a lot of coaches think, you know, an ideal practice is one that goes seamless from beginning to end with zero mistakes, right? You'll see that a lot in American football. You know, a lineman who can get off their spot and hit the slide and get through real quick with no mistakes. That's almost like a rehearsal for a play, when in reality, the game is a whole lot messier than that. So it really prepares these kids and athletes at all levels for the adversity and challenges they're going to be facing in a game. And also these are principles that just apply to life in terms of problem solving, getting better and learning. So.
Great. So understanding these theories is critical, because everybody has a theory. Everyone's using a theory. I mean, whether they know it or not, they're using a theory. The thing is, you can't get a PhD in most of those theories. This is actually the most contemporary evidence and science on the planet for how human beings move, how we learn, how we operate, and learning that and then applying it to a coaching methodology. It just makes so much sense. it's kind of funny. You're talking about the messiness of games. Any coach who's pretty good can make a practice really clean. Any coach,
of course.
It's really easy to do it. You just script it out. And if generally it'll be really clean. But the thing is, if you have a really, really clean practice, it's like fool's gold. And I think that's one of the things that's very, very hard for people to wrap their head around is like, well, I mean, if they're not doing it well, we must, have to figure out a way to make them do it perfectly. When really the game is messy. Did you watch the Syracuse Duke game the other night? It was messy. They didn't score a ton of goals. It's just the way it happens. Even at the very highest levels, it can be very, very messy. But really, they're getting better during that messiness.
Exactly. So, and just real quick, I think part of it too is a mindset of a lot of people talk about, the best coaches are playing chess, not checkers. The best coaches are doing neither, because the thing is if you're training in a particular way, the other team is training that way too. And you want spacing, you want good shots and different things like that. So if you're going to, just go based off of that and you want it to be sweet and rehearsed and not really account for the messiness of things, you're not really preparing them for the dynamic stuff that's actually going to happen in a game, So like you said, the best coaches, any good coach can make a practice look clean,
Totally. All right. So you may say like, all right, well then how are you really even going to do this?
Yes.
With such a big group. And so we're kind of getting started with these first four priorities, which is number one, we're asking all the coaches to be really conscious of time on task. How quickly can we mobilize the players into their activities using the rule of two or three? Always using multiple goals and multiple groups so that we can optimize, reps of decision-making reps. Yep. Not all reps are created equal. And really thinking about it kind of like a ball to kid ratio. If you have one activity with 22 kids and one ball, you could do three times better if you had three groups. Yeah. Go ahead. Any thoughts on that? This is not
serious. I was just going to say to that point, at this level in particular, a lot of these coaches aren't full-time coaches. They're volunteer. They have full-time jobs. They have families and different things like that. They have limited time to prepare, spend time with these kids. They have limited time to practice. So what this is kind of doing too is it's making the most efficient use of your time, because if you're running these drills and there's long lines and kids are only getting 2 to 3 reps, for a 15 or 20 minute drill, and more than half that time they're waiting. Is that really developing anything, in any meaningful way? I don't know. I don't think so.
It's very obvious that the efficiency of this is it's undeniable. You need to get as many reps. You got 2 90 minute practices twice a week. One of the things that I've heard so many times over the years where a coach will be like, the field is like my classroom. I'm a teacher of the game. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, that's going to be the worst practice ever. because the whole Snoopy thing where the teachers and parents are talking and it's just like, that's basically what happens, which is why I want to explain what the rule of two or three is. When you're trying to mobilize your kids into doing something, if you try to explain all of the details of an activity, it'll take too long and they won't really remember very much of it. The biggest key to this is mobilize them into something incredibly simple. Let's just say you wanted to have a quick game of 3x. You'd say, all right, guys, give me 3 whites and 3 reds. and here's the game. Right. When red's on offense, one of the white players has to play goalie. And that goalie has to count down a 12-second shot clock. Okay, ready, go. That's it. That's all they need. And then they're going to look at you like, wait, what? And then you just kind of like, yeah, it's a three. Basically it's a 3-on-2, guys. Just face it off and let's play. And then you just get them going. Mm-hmm. Then you can be like, okay, guys, you can start adding all the constraints that you might want to get going. You can say, well, we're going to have a space constraint. We're going to have set some picks. We're going to have an outside the arc constraint, put it on a side. There's endless things we can do to change up that environment, but we can't explain it all at once. And so this is something that takes practice. And I just wanted to sort of didn't want to spend too much time on this and that because it makes so much sense. But let's talk about the next thing we are asking them. So number one was time on tax. Number two was an 80-20 split of small-sided contextual activities and drills that would be just stick work type of drills. Thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if I think if you and I had it our way, everybody would get it intuitively, you know, like we do, or, you know, dive down the rabbit hole and be as excited. But again, it comes down to a time thing. And so we would want like 100%, you know, completely contextualized. The reason I think you and I advocate for an 80-20 split is you want the majority of it to be contextual and representative of the game. But at the same time, you know, there are creature comforts for certain coaches. You can't fault someone for the system that they came up in, right? And the way that they were taught to coach and do different things. And sometimes it is just a matter of establishing some type of order or routine or kind of corralling the guys at the team in a particular way where they can get ready to do the rest of the practice, right? It has a little bit of routine base. And also a lot of that stuff you can see some easy successes in, and it feels good to be good at something, right? And it's much easier to be good with the on-air stuff, you know, just doing stick work or different things like that, as opposed to 100% messy, dynamic, and someone could just have a seemingly bad practice. They may not realize that they're learning at a high level, you know, because this is a nonlinear approach, but they may not have this clean practice. And if it was 100% that, they may walk away with their confidence hit a little bit. So what this does is it kind of gives them a foundation to really establish themselves in a comfortable way to both as coaches and as the players. I think it's a framework that lets people do what they feel they know works, but also gives them the freedom to explore these other things as well, knowing that they can come back to that touch point.
For sure. And a couple points on my end on this 80-20 split. Look, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing certain levels of stick work in certain ways, because the ability to throw and catch, particularly on the run at variable distances and variable speeds, is really, really important. And so therefore, I think that there's value in being able to rep those out. However, when you're separated too much from decisions, you know, it means that you're going to have to kind of do it twice, because you're going to have to do the same thing again with defenders. So I kind of keep it to, you know, partner or three player passing where they just kind of get up and down the field. It's a ball to kid ratio of like 1-2 or 1-3. We crank it out in like 5 or 10 minutes. We create variability, which has some benefits, such, you know, in terms of thought, thinking about differential learning. And it allows us then to really knock out the throwing and catching in a very, very high volume way, in a pretty realistic way. For people that are like, yeah, but that's only up and down the field. What about my half field stick work? And what I would say is play keep away. Your keep away is your contextual small-sided version of the half field type of stick work you're going to need to do. And so we'll talk about that a little bit later. The other thing with this 80% is kids like playing much more than they like doing things 100%. Against air. And it is so much more fun for everybody.
Absolutely.
And given the fact that we only have 90 minutes twice a week, it allows us to practice our offense and defense simultaneously, which is like a kill two birds with one stone every single time you run a various drill activity.
Yeah, it forces that structure of the majority of it will be fun and engaging for these kids too. And if, you know, if we want to get technical about that 20%, you know, the stick work, that's part of, you know, task simplification, which is part of, you know, nonlinear pedagogy. You simplify the task based off the expertise level. Well, the most simple the task can be is on air and with nobody, right? So like you said, you'll have to ultimately do it twice with a defender. But if somebody can't get it down by themselves, it's going to be a little bit harder for them to do it with a defender. So it's okay to spend a little bit of time on that and then move on. Right.
Yep. So let's talk about the third priority, which is changing and officiating constraints. Now, I want to share something with you all about contextual environments and CLA and stuff like this. Almost everybody does some things that are contextual. Everybody does.
Of course.
The biggest thing that I've learned over the last 6 or 9 months that has made a massive difference in my coaching is to change constraints much, much, much more frequently. I was always aware that it was the environment that were creating these emerging behaviors. And I was aware of being intentional about creating environments to create and to see if I could get a behavior that I was looking for to emerge. What I didn't understand was how important it is to change these constraints much more often. And I would fall in love with a drill, and it was a great drill and a great drill environment, but I would tend to do that drill instead of tweaking it into many different ways. And I've found through working with JM3 athletes over the last number of months that we've seen so much more improvement, and it's so much more fun for the athletes. So can you talk about why variability and changing constraints, even before you get into being very, very intentional, is very important?
Yeah, I think so. There's a few different ways to think of it too. If you're as a coach focused on changing constraints, you're going to be inherently less focused on providing technical feedback. So jumping in and saying why a move was wrong or how someone needs to do something in a particular way. That's one thing. The other is I think it inherently keeps the player and the coach more engaged with what's going on during the activity instead of at some point they may get so good at it, they kind of go on autopilot. They know what's going to happen. So it takes the decision-making out of it, right? They know how it's supposed to go after a certain amount of reps and it's not going to change. So they're just going to kind of step back or go on cruise control, not even intentionally sometimes. You know, we all do this. Even when you drive to work, sometimes you get to work and you're like, how the heck did I get here? You know, we all go along the same path enough times. It's going to get easier and things like that. So I think it is wonderful for not just decision making, but it teaches kids and coaches to stay engaged with what's going on, right? And very rarely in a game is the same thing going to happen over and over and over and over again. And if it is, guess what? As a coach, if you can recognize that and exploit it, you're going to destroy the other team. You know what I mean? So it's more representative just by making it more dynamic in that aspect.
For sure. Games are incredibly dynamic and unpredictable and uncontrollable. And so therefore, if you want to think about what a great coach does, they prepare their players. And what does that even mean? It's preparing them to be adaptive to as many different things as possible. So if you have a favorite drill, all you have to do is make small changes, small changes in constraints. Maybe it's a different defensive coverage. Maybe you switch the pick instead of stay, or you double the pick instead of stay and go under, or maybe you run different actions. You have different space constraints, shot clocks. There's so many things that you can do that are very, very simple and minor. They don't really change the construct of the drill. Right. We don't want to have a brand new drill set up every single time. You don't need one. All you have to do is tweak some constraints to get this.
And that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, and that's the other thing too, is that I've been finding, like in some of the work I've been doing at Transforming Sports, you know, talking to a variety of coaches across all sorts of programs, is a lot of these coaches, they have wonderful drills, you know, and wonderful games and, you know, activities to develop skill. And I think sometimes the hesitancy is the idea of, oh no, I have to go back to the drawing board and figure it all out all over again. And really it's not that at all. It's just like you're saying, add a little bit of variability to what you're already doing, and it's going to accelerate things in a really positive way. So I think that's sometimes an initial hurdle, but once you can see past that, that really, like, you have the infrastructure, just change it up every now and then you'll really see the results.
Exactly. Here's another really, really interesting thought with regard to why the CLA is so powerful, not only for athletes, but for coaches. Yep. A second ago, I said, what is a trait of a great coach? And it's to prepare your players. Another one is ability to make adjustments. What is changing constraints, especially when they become not just random, but intentional? It's making adjustments. When you see in a game that there is a certain coverage that's giving your team a hard time and you recognize what that is and you get them to do another action, that is the example of a coach making an adjustment in a game. And this will happen in all the phases of the game. You are literally practicing making adjustments every single time. You are changing constraints and beginning to understand what is the emerging behavior of both sides of the ball. And you become an expert at both sides of the ball, which you must be. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think it also, to that point, it makes you more flexible in the sense of you're able to identify things that aren't working quicker, right? By changing constraints, you know, often and frequently, you might be able to go, oh, wow, that was really great. You know, they responded really well to that. Or, oh man, they struggled with that. Maybe that's an area we need to work on. Or, oh, actually, I didn't do a good job of designing that. But what it's going to do is it's going to break you out of these patterns of, instead of trying to make something work, it's going to empower you to go find something else that does, you know? And that's like such a subtle shift in mindset and approach to the game and practice and everything, that it's not just making your players better, you know, during practice, it's going to make you better. And that's the, like, the beautiful thing about the entire approach is it's completely co-developmental, right? It's not for you to just show up to practice and, you know, employ this script and, you know, drill these ideas and these techniques into these kids. And then once you get to the game, hands off, they should have it figured out, you know, and then if it doesn't work out, it's on them. It co-develops you to be engaged, make adjustments, make quick decisions, not be married to a particular solution. Because guess what? It may be the right play. It may be the right, you know, tactic or whatever it may be, but it just may be the wrong day. You know, there are so many factors that can go into execution falling apart. So what do you do? You know, I often think about Bill Belichick, one of my favorite coaches ever. You know, he used to say all the time, like, I don't have a system. You know, I look at my players at the beginning of each year and then I have a system. Well, all that's going to do is, and he used to take away the other team's best asset, right? Because most people aren't good once you do that. You know, I liken it to, why don't you try and do everything you do in your day with your offhand? Brush your teeth, you know, tie your shoes, you know, and do all these other things with your offhand. What can you do when your best asset or your best tool is taken away from you? And so many people can't adjust to that. But if you're practicing this at such a high level and changing constraints frequently, you're inherently giving yourself more reps in doing that, you know? So I think that really is a very powerful point for a lot of coaches to consider.
For sure. All right. So we covered the first three priorities: time on task, small sided in context, 80-20, and then changing and officiating constraints. I don't want to spend any more time on constraints for right now, but officiating them is just as important as changing them, because basically, you know, if you have an out of bounds on a keep away game and you let everybody go out of bounds without turning it over, it's like there's no constraint there. So that's kind of obvious, but it really needs to be followed through on. The next thing we started to talk about was, okay, how do we actually employ all of this stuff? Sounds great, but how do I get, you know, a man up and a man down, or a transition, or ride a clear? So we're basically saying, look, there are six major phases of the game: offense, defense, transition offense and clearing, transition defense and riding, man up and man down. And so we're going to try to find small-sided activities that allow us, that are representative of all of those situations. And again, because of a limited amount of time, we're going to need to try to figure out a way to kill not just two birds with one stone, because we can do offense and defense or man up and man down, but maybe three or four birds with one stone by maybe adding a pick action to an uneven drill that allows us then to kind of work on, you know, man up, man down, and the actions of an all even, and maybe even something that would represent a similar situation to transition. And so that is just a concept for looking at how you're going to, you know, begin thinking about all of this. Right. And then we get into principles of play.
Yep.
Principles of play, in my opinion, are the true fundamentals of the game. Yep. Everyone will label a fundamental as a technique, like overhand or two hands on the stick when you're scooping, and all of these specific techniques that are been labeled fundamental, when really I believe the fundamentals of the game are the concepts or the principles of play. Can you talk about why what I've just said conceptually is so important for having an ecological approach to coaching?
Of course. Yeah. So again, I think it goes back to that flexibility component, right? Like, if you're worried and obsessed about techniques as the fundamentals of the game, you're almost missing the forest for the trees, in the sense of you're going to be looking at was that performed in the right way, and not even necessarily looking at the outcome of it, and not even the process of it, but just a decomposed component of it. Whereas if you have these principles, it allows you to be flexible, right? If you have a principle of play that emphasizes spacing, well, spacing can be in very, very compact parts of the field, or it can be the entire part of the field. It can be, different in a different phase of the game, right? And you can adjust and employ these in different scenarios, and it gives you something to, it's your foundation that you fall back on. And you realize, as long as we're operating within these principles, it gives me the creativity to go out and find different solutions to operate within them, right? Whether that is, having a different approach or changing your pressure based off the team that you're playing, as long as like the principles are the same, and you're operating within them, then your team has it basically imbues a more coherent understanding for not just you, but your team and what they're operating under, instead of worrying about, oh, did I do this play right? Did I do this movement in a correct way? Okay. They're just trying to achieve these six high level things, or whatever number of principles of play you may have, these high level things that you're trying to achieve, and that goes back to the rule of two or three, right? Instead of drilling all of these fundamentals, almost like a dictionary that they have to pull out, and do correctly at any given time, they have the freedom to kind of know that as long as I'm operating within, how we like to play the game, that I can go out and find any solution to get it done. And I think that is incredibly powerful. And again, it takes the onus away from inside the individual and makes them engage with what's going on in the game, the environment, and how it's actually unfolding in real time, as opposed to completely decontextualized.
Right. So. Functional variability is an NLP term, which basically says, don't worry about how someone's getting the job done or what it looks like. It's everybody is different. Everybody does different things and every situation is different. So when we think about principles of play and we think about focusing on the fundamental of this principle. So let's just talk about one specifically, possession, being able to possess the ball and to be able to handle pressure. Usually people will focus on throwing with a specific technique overhand.
Right.
And they won't like, and they'll want people to switch hands all the time and catch it with their stick to the outside at all times, and throw it with their, weak hand when they're supposed to, and all of these traditional fundamentals. But really, if a player is really good at receiving the ball and making a pass under pressure and they can handle it, do we really care how they do it? Should we really care how they do it and why?
Absolutely not. To draw a basketball parallel, look at Nikola Jokic. If you looked at his passing highlights, he would have gotten thrown out of any gym 15, 20 years ago. Those aren't chest passes. Those aren't overhead passes. They're not, clean bounce passes or anything like that. They're ugly. They're quick touches. Sometimes he's not even looking at the player, but you know what happens every time? The other person gets the ball and they more often than not, they put it in the hoop. So to criticize someone on the technique when the outcome is exactly what you're wanting within that, offensive principle of play, again, seems to kind of be losing the forest for the trees there. And I think is a misguided approach to coaching. And if anything, it speaks to how rigid you are as a coach and how you think the game should look, as opposed to, hey, I want the team to have fun. And I want them to play well, and we want to win. Winning's fun. At the youth level, obviously you want to develop, all these other things, but winning's fun. Not a lot of teams don't have fun winning. And the ones that do, they get burnt out real quick,
Totally. So, back to some of these fundamentals that really, I would call fake fundamentals, overhand as well.
Yeah.
Because what I mean by fake is that, like, well, if you're telling me that you have to be able to do all this, but yet it doesn't actually even happen. You can't even throw an overhand pass under pressure.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, why is that so emphasized? Just because theoretically
it's you know, theoretically it would be more accurate because you only have to worry about accuracy high and low and not, right. You know, side to side. And, you know, look, I think that there's different deception in a swing, like overhand. You know, it's easier to kind of hold a goalie up and pull it down and hit the net, right? Whereas, so it's not that overhand is bad. It's really important. No. It's just that this belief that you should only do that and to discourage other angles of swinging your stick, such as three quarters or sidearm or underhand, or behind the back or backhand or twisters. These are all a part of it also, and they're all going to be solutions in different ways. But
It kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the sense of in preparation as a coach. If every coach is emphasizing you can only do it underhand, guess what? The other team knows how you're going to how you're going to make that pass, and that's guess how they're going to defend it. You know, that's it doesn't work like that. So.
But what I really wanted to kind of get to is more on these principles of play. Because instead of spending your whole practice emphasizing these techniques, what if you spent your whole practice emphasizing things like shot selection, putting them in situations to handle pressure, dodging angles, vision, scanning, moving the ball, outlets, swinging the ball through X, spacing for Dodgers, spacing for two-man games, opening up the middle. Picking, creating advantages, capitalizing on advantages, draw and dump, communication, deception, reading the defense. These are the principles of play.
Absolutely.
And these principles of play become the guiding light for your evaluation as a coach, your evaluation of an individual as well as the group that will tell you what to do. Instead of worrying about technique ever, worry about the outcome of these principles of play, and they will become the North Star for your entire program, gaining the intention and attention of your players and your staff in the most important things. So talk a little bit about why principles of play are a constraint for your program in a very positive way.
Yeah, they guide, I think it goes back to decision-making, right? They guide decisions. And so if we want to go back to the possession and handling pressure, right, and moving the ball quickly, if you're overemphasizing a technique, that overhand technique, so to speak, you're over-constraining the decision-making, right? As opposed to them getting the ball and just going, all right, move it quickly or handle the pressure, whatever it is that, you know, they're operating under in terms of those principles, they're thinking, move the ball, do it overhand, or do I have the opportunity to do it this way? And it is an inherently longer decision-making process. So I think you can over-constrain people, right? And I think that is a very, very crucial thing to consider. Whereas principles, they're constraints, they're they're ways to guide behavior and, principles to operate under for your game. Whereas techniques and fundamentals are over constraining because it's not just telling you what to do in terms of, you know, a principle, but it's telling you how to do it. That's an extra semantic layer to have to worry about during the game. And it's a longer decision-making process.
And it's not even telling you what to do, honestly. And that's the whole point of the principles telling you is how to do it. It's not telling you what you're doing is the key. Not exactly how you do it. And if you really look closely, everyone does it differently anyway. So it's like absurd to think you have one way to do it. And this allows us to focus on the most important things in your offense and your defense. And so we're providing this list of principles of play, and we're asking coaches to look at these principles of play and then look and pick a few on offense, a few on defense, and see if they're happening or not happening, and then you can emphasize them. Again, you can't emphasize 20 different principles of play, but you can pick a few and you can have some activities that you know. For example, if you play an all-even keep-away game, you're going to have a great opportunity to learn how to learn how to handle pressure and possess the ball. You can add pick actions that would allow you to learn how to start reading the defense and all these things. So you can build it into your practices where you kind of know what the principles of play are going to be, and that is what we want to focus on.
Right. And I think to go back to the what and the how of things too, real quick, is I think principles give a more robust answer or a more robust kind of solution space to answer why are we doing this. To go back again to the overhead thing, I just ask why that's emphasized, right? Well, okay, that makes a whole lot of sense. But then when you're emphasizing these techniques and different things, and then you ask the why about that, it's always going to be followed by a, well, what if? You know, what if that's defended in a particular way? And right. Then you have to move on to another thing. Whereas these principles kind of give you the why we're doing this, and they let you figure out the how and the what and different things like that. And I think that is a really powerful way to think about it too.
Well, and the other thing for everybody, these principles of play are really not debatable. They exist.
Exactly.
They exist right. All the time. And what it allows you to do is just actually focus on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are the most important thing. And everybody would say this, regardless of whatever offense you run or what defense you would run, you would have, and you might emphasize one principle of play, maybe more than another, but on defense, it's stop the ball, get in the hole, protect the middle, approaches, ball pressure, vision, communication, slide and recover, double teams, rotating, reading the quality of defense on the ball, guard more than one person, slow play, holding. The list goes on. You know, there's probably 15 or 20 of these general principles of play that are in existence. You may mm-hmm. want to play defense that slides more than somebody else. So you might put a little bit more emphasis on slide and recover than on how you're going to be hard to beat. But bottom line is, by putting your attention on structure and on technique, you're taking attention away from the most important part. And you're trying to control something that's uncontrollable anyways. And so it really just dilutes your ability to focus on the most important things. All right, so what I tried to do was create a simple list of activities and give a list of constraints. Right. And what so many coaching clinics and coach education models basically have an expert come in and run a practice, and it looks great. And then when that coach leaves, it just is back to what it was. Or they give them a copy and paste practice plan and just go do it. And nothing actually really changes, because all of this requires more of not just giving a man a fish, but teaching a man to fish. So what we're trying to do is arm everyone and allow them to just go do it on their own. Meet them where they are. Look, whatever practice plan you've been doing, go for it. We can give you a template of saying, look, you know, if you play some small games with small nets and change up the various uneven and all even games, you know, small nets are an incredible constraint. And I would tell you that you will get amazing mileage out of that. And so we're giving them this sort of practice plan template, but really it's up to every single coach.
Yeah, and it's going to be different every time too, right? Because not all teams are the same. You know, not everyone's going to have the same development, the same skill set, all these different things. So what's no one like? You're going to probably know more about lacrosse than most in every room that you walk in, right? But you're not always going to know more about the coach's team that you're there to, you know, help with than that coach, right? They know them, they see them. And so you can take these practice plans, these activities, these templates, and these, even the principles of play, and apply it to how it fits your team and based off your team needs, as opposed to, again, like you were talking about with the clinic example of just, you know, handing a script over and saying, do it like this.
Yeah, exactly. There's not one way to do it. We did give a practice plan template just to be able to have somebody have something to reference. We have our sandlot games, which are the small net games for 20 minutes, and stick work, 2-man and 3-man stuff for 10 minutes, keep away for 10 minutes, a little offense defense segment where the O gets to go play offense and defense against each other, and the poles get to go play offense and defense against each other to focus a little bit on some of those scenarios where we can separate them. Honestly, not having your poles present is really good for the offense at times, because it's an actual difficult constraint to always go against poles and learn things. Mm-hmm. We have a segment for 15 minutes of you know, it's pretty general. It says transition right, clear, EMO, EMD. Why? Well, because it depends on what we did during the Sandlot games and the keep away in the offense defense right. segment to tell us what we're going to do. But we're sort of getting into some team play and then team offense and team defense. So next we gave them this activities list of all kinds of different Sandlot games, 2-on-2 plus a feeder, 3-on-3 plus a feeder, 3-by, 4-by, 3-by on a side, 3-by tight, 3-by outside the arc, all of these different types of keep away environments. And the reason why is just because, look, everybody, as far as I'm concerned, should just do whatever you want as long as you try to stick to the four priorities from the beginning, right?
Exactly.
And then if you take your general uneven buildup, that's a 2-on-1 to a 3-on-2 to a 4-on-3 to a 5-on-4. I love it. Figure out ways to change the constraints. Figure out ways to see if principles of play are being followed. Is the defense slow playing? Are they getting in and protecting the middle? Are they making the offense make a lot of passes? These are the things that you will now emphasize and be aware of so that you can change constraints to try to create an emerging behavior that fits the principles of play that you want. And so, you know, it's such more of a do-it-yourself model that we're trying to create. And so any thoughts on how people construct their practices as it relates to how big, how small, how worried they should be about their X's and O's and then how to actually execute those?
Yeah, I think, again, so to go off the list and different things that you've put together and provided some of these coaches, these are suggestions, these are ideas, and they're based off your experience and your practical know-how and different things like that. It's not gospel. It's not that you must follow this or you'll fail. You know, these are just ideas in case someone's running short. But again, we're emphasizing, hey, you know, your practice should be based off what you are seeing with your team, what's actually happening, what's unfolding. What did you do in the early part of the practice and see? How can you address that later? Again, it's forcing you as a coach, I think, to stay engaged with what's going on instead of showing up and just following a plan and sticking to that plan no matter what. Because if you do that, you're going to do it in games and it's just going to make you more rigid. You know, your plan, if you only have one plan, think of it as only having one solution, one option, right?
Right.
And you're very, very rigid. It may be a great plan. It may be wonderful. But if something goes left, you're going to be toppled over really, really easy, as opposed to if you had a really wide foundation that you can choose from and do these different things. So I think keeping that in mind when you're designing these practices based off your team, what's been going on during the season? How did the last game go? You know, don't be agnostic to what is actually happening, you know, with your team. Pay attention to those things, incorporate it into, you know, the games you're choosing, the constraints you're changing, and how the performance is unfolding, as opposed to what you think should be happening and how it should be happening and in the order it should be happening, right? It's going to be messy. It's going to be ugly at times, but the more you do it, you're going to get more acquainted with I guess, you know, uncomfortability, like being outside of your comfort zone. You know, people talk about that as being, you know, you need to get outside your comfort zone, you know, a growth mindset, different things like that. However you want to construct it, it's going to do that for you as a coach. And if you can do that as a coach, you're going to lead by example for your players. And I think that's really, really important.
For sure. You brought up a really good point, which is you need to look at your last game and find out what you're doing well and what you're not. And the terminology that we learned from Alex is rate limiters.
Yep.
And a rate limiter is basically something that's holding an individual back from their best or your team. And it's really all based on, you know, on the team level, it's all based on principles of play.
Yep.
And so when you think about the last time you played a game, what was it that you struggled with? Well, we didn't really create enough. We didn't shoot well, somebody might say.
Right.
But was it really that you didn't shoot well? Did you actually generate a lot of great shots?
There it is.
Well, we did actually. Or did you actually generate a lot of advantages to create those shots? Because if you can figure out what it actually was that you weren't doing well, you can then attack it in practice with various constraints. So, for example, let's just say we were beating people, but we weren't getting great shots. Well, that's probably because we weren't capitalizing on advantages. We were creating advantages off the dodge, but we weren't moving the ball. Our spacing wasn't great. We were allowing the team to slide on us and allowed, you know, one defender to guard two, or the ball just didn't, the ball was dying in somebody's stick and they were getting back to neutral. This is an example of how we can view what happened in the last game, and then we can figure out activities that can attack that. And such an activity would be like, okay, let's do a 3-on-3 with an advantage start. We're going to really give a step to the dodger by setting up the defender so that they're, let's say they're giving the middle on a 45 degree angle to the middle from out top. The defense is going to have to slide, and we're going to figure out how to read that slide, have good spacing with the off-ball players, and be able to move the ball or score it depending on whether they slide or not. Now, meanwhile, this is obviously great for the defense too, but this is an example of how you can look at rate limiters, how to construct an activity and use constraints that would allow you to attack that rate limiter.
Absolutely. Instead of looking at it as a team or a player weakness, right? Look at it as, you know, an opportunity to address something. You know, don't look at it as we can't do this thing. Instead, look at it as, okay, this is an area we should be focused on in the next practice, in the next session, or the next game, or whatever. So if I could sum like the entire approach up, you know, from a coaching perspective, it would be, be intentional, you know, be intentional with everything you're doing, you know, be intentional with your principles of play, be intentional, you know, with your game choices and your constraint manipulations. Don't just, it's great. Like if you're just getting started, like doing it at all is a wonderful, huge step. But as you go along, keep thinking about that intentionality component and why are we doing this? You know, what is it that's causing us to focus on this right now? Was it the previous game or is it just something I think I saw based off, I didn't like how that pass looked, you know? And if it's the latter, that's not really going to be very informative. You want to be intentional and you want it to be representative of what's actually going on, not what you think should be going on.
Yeah, totally. And intentional, just to be clear, intentionality is critical, but you must be looking at this through this ecological lens of understanding that humans are completely, what they do is relative to their environment, and that we've got these principles of play that we're looking at. So you see it all the time where somebody will be like, well, you know, we got to really work on our defensive footwork because we, you know, we're not covering people very well one-on-one. You know, you really got to work on it. And so they go off and work on isolated defensive footwork as if really that was the problem. It might be. Right. Maybe you don't have very fast athletes. But really, on defense, it's usually not being in position. It's a bad shape. It's not enough cushion. It's not knowing a guy's a lefty. It's not realizing that you're really near the crease instead of really far from it. It could be that, you know, the rest of the, you know, you have to slide to this guy and you're not. And so really seeing the principles of play will allow us to be intentional with this ecological lens to figure out what activities that we can do. And this is just true everywhere. It's the same thing. The possession example is so good. Oh, we turn the ball over a million times. We got to really work on our stick skills. If you work on your stick skills without putting the pressure on, you're just going to have to go struggle
do it again
against pressure again until you play against enough pressure that you learn how to do it.
Right. So. It again, not just how it looks, but like, how is it being, how's the process? Like what are the outcomes, you know? Cause it can look great, like you said, in practice on air, and more often than not, it's going to at some point, but you know, what's going to happen when that defense, when the defense is there, is it going to be the same thing? So if you're not practicing that or addressing that in some, you know, realistic way, and again, this isn't saying, you know, go play full games of lacrosse during your practices. In no way is it saying that at all, because, you know, you have to take these little slices because, you know, these examples we're talking about may only occur once or twice in a game, but it may be a critical point, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're playing full on lacrosse every practice, that still only may occur once or twice. So think about an activity that you can design that's going to address it where a player gets 10, 15 reps in an entire practice with it, you know, in a 90-minute span, whereas before they were only getting maybe once or twice a week. You know, it's a huge difference.
It is. And it's so exciting. Gray, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I love working with you. And I really look forward to working with you all spring.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to everything we have going on together with this and all the opportunities in the future. I really appreciate you, Jamie.
Yeah, man. Be in touch.
Yep.